readers and writers. Welcome to episode 119 of Read and Write. Today we're talking about old dead projects with our guest, Danelle Lejeune. She's a writer and poet. You can find her on Twitter at Danelle Lejeune or on Instagram at Danelle Lejeune Author or on Facebook, Danelle Lejeune Author. Her latest book is a book called Pig, and Pig is a consumer's guide to buying farm-to-table meat. Hi, Danelle.
Hi.
So tell me about Pig.
Pig was a project I started so many years ago when I was a pig farmer. And what I learned being a pig farmer and being a pork consumer before that was that all the questions I ask as a consumer and being on the farmer end of it, I learned that everyone was asking the wrong questions. So what are the right questions and how do we navigate through the process if we're an individual, not a grocery store, trying to buy directly from a farmer to get the best quality meat that we ethically, what our ethics are that are important to us, that matches up. And right. So the first part of the book is actually discovering what your own ethic compass is, because it's not all the same. Some people care about animal welfare. Some people care about what the animal is fed. Some people care more about breeds or animal farm conditions, like whether or not it's raised in pasture versus timber,
right.
Whether or not it's raised like in a small batch versus a large batch, whether or not it has a endorsement like animal welfare approved, right? So you determine what's important to you before moving on to find the farmer. And then the farmer will also have a set of things, right? And so you learn what that language is, because there's a very special jargon in pig farming. And so it's a guide through that.
Okay.
And it kind of walks the consumer step by step to understanding what the different breeds are, why they matter or don't, what the feeds are and why those matter or don't. And because some of the feeds that are advertised as making a difference don't really. And then it goes through, so you have that, you've agreed to buy a pig. Where does it go there? Does it just magically show up at your door? No, it goes to a butcher. And the butchering process is another step in the ethical process. Most people don't realize that. Some butchers are not ethical butchers. They don't slaughter the animals in a kind way, and some do. So it walks people through choosing a butcher.
Makes my bleeding heart hurt.
Right, right. A lot of people go vegan because of ethics, and then they have to go back to eating meat because of health reasons. And so we had a lot of customers like that when I was a pig farmer too. But the butcher, you also have to choose what cuts. And the choosing is kind of an interesting process that most people aren't prepared for. You know, you get pork chops, you get bacon, but there's about 30 to 100 other cuts. And with an entire pig, you're going to get a lot of
them. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I walk people through what those cuts are, how to figure it out.
It sounds overwhelming.
It is. It's a whole book. Right.
Fair enough.
So yeah. And then it goes how to store it, how to freeze it, and then how to cook with it. Because you may know how to make pork chops. Actually, most people don't know how to successfully make pork chops or how to cook bacon because it's not microwavable bacon.
Right.
And just so the normal things, and everything is simple. It's not fancy, high-end culinary stuff. It's simple recipes you can make with kids running underfoot.
Always
really
helpful.
Simplified. But for every possible cut, right? And even a rescue section, like you messed this up, here's how to fix it.
Oh, that's nice.
So, and then, you know, stories woven in how I learned these things, because I did set things on fire at various points. You know, I was not a star student in the kitchen. And, you know, some of the stories of people coming to my farm once I was a farmer, I had a woman show up wearing Louboutins during mud season.
Ooh.
For those of you who don't know what Louboutins are, I didn't until then.
Fancy
they're the
red shoes.
Shoes. And they're beautiful. Fancy red shoes. They should not, they will sink ankle deep in the mud.
Oh my God. I'm just picturing this. That poor woman.
She actually didn't mind as much as I was horrified. You know, she was just right out there like, let's go see the pigs. And she didn't care.
Oh,
she's like,
God.
All right. So this wasn't the right shoes. And she took them off, carried them and walked. And I'm like, barefoot's not good either. But she was great. I
Can I loan you, you a know, pair of boots?
She's actually one of the customers who got her.
Yeah.
After that, I started keeping Crocs and boots of That's various nice. Sizes on hand for customers who came. Yeah. Yeah. But she's one of the customers that after I left pig farming because of a terrible divorce and he got the farm, I got the kids. She called and said, I'm looking for another pig farmer. And can you walk me through how to do that? And another customer called me and said, I'm trying to work through this butcher sheet. Can you explain to me again how to do it? You should make a book out of this. And so it took me 5 years of people calling me still, like, I know you're not a pig farmer anymore. Can you help me? And even one of my old butchers that we would take our animals to said mm-hmm. that my butcher sheet I made for people that was different than theirs was actually more helpful for new customers than the one that they had standard.
Well, that was nice.
So, you know, all of this encouragement, people kept pushing me to this, but I kept saying, I'm not a farmer anymore. I don't feel like I have the credibility to write about this anymore. And they kept pushing like, well, you were a consumer and now you're a consumer again, and you have the experience, just write about it, just do it. And so I did.
And that was an old dead project for you.
I picked up that dead project. It was a dead project and I revived it. And it was hard because I had to go through a lot of notes and pictures from the life I had before and don't now. And mm-hmm. so it was also therapeutic.
It sounds like it would be.
And hopefully it will be a helpful thing. Yeah. Yeah. I hope it'll be a helpful project to go out of the world. I have encountered roadblocks in the publishing process. One, everybody loves it. That's not a roadblock. But the part that is there is no book like it. There's no book like it out there.
Right.
It fills a gap that exists. And so they don't know how to market it or who would buy it. And my exclamations in these meetings of everyone will buy it isn't exactly correct.
I could see that.
So my job now, my job now for the next 6 months to a year is to do as many promotional things like this mm-hmm. and create my own podcast and newsletter and get as many people saying, yeah, I would buy it, that they'll look at it.
Good.
For publication.
Well, I hope your efforts go well.
Yeah. I hope so too. I hope so too. In the meantime, I'm just plugging away, reviewing and taste testing all sorts of different kinds of bacon. And
that sounds like fun.
And recipes and cookbooks. And it really is, except when the bacon is bad.
Oh, too salty.
Yeah. I taste tested beef bacon.
Okay.
And I'm not a fan. I didn't know such a thing existed. I hope my beef cattle friend. It's made from a brisket cut, and I just don't care for it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe someone will send me more free packages and that's more.
My youngest, for some reason, just doesn't like meat. Like, just naturally, out of the womb, doesn't really like meat. So I give him a lot of vegan stuff, and we got this vegan bacon, and my husband hates it. He's like, this does not taste like bacon, but the four-year-old loves it. I don't know what it tastes like to him, but it definitely doesn't taste like bacon.
No, I've taste tested vegan bacon
mm-hmm.
and to me it tasted like cardboard.
It definitely has like that. It doesn't have like the crispiness that a bacon has. It just kind of like, it kind of feels like you're chewing on several sheets of paper. It has that texture to it.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
It's yeah. just pressed soy.
No, I thought, well, can we chop it up and like crumble it over a salad? Would that uh-huh. be good? We tried that and no. No, my kids are like, why did you put cardboard in the salad? Like fiber. It's fiber.
Well, my four-year-old is gaga for it, but he doesn't like regular bacon, so he's weird. Okay, so
maybe
what other,
he's allergic to it.
I don't know. I don't know why. He just doesn't like just pretty much any traditional meat. He just is not a fan. He likes a lot of the vegan options, though, so at least he's getting protein some way. And the kid, the 4-year-old loves chickpeas. And that seems really strange to me. Like, I didn't grow to like pick chickpeas until I was an adult. But he just loves them.
Same. Chickpeas are what, or is that what's in hummus?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. Yeah. I thought growing up hummus was haggis. And I thought it was really weird that people liked to eat it. And then I went to my first mom's group with a baby on my hip and they're like, here, have some hummus. And I'm like, oh no, why are you all eating that? And then they explained to me that it was made from chickpeas, not sausage and various things wrapped in the stomach of a sheep.
Yeah, that does sound kind of gross.
Scottish delicacy, and I felt very silly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, not haggis.
No. Hummus. Yeah, hummus is good, and I don't know why we're going down the road of what my 4-year-old likes to eat, but he loves chickpeas and hummus because he's a strange dead one.
Projects,
right? So tell me about your old dead projects.
So I have a couple that are like still in drawers. My poetry, I actually took a 20-year hiatus from writing poetry, and I pulled. Whoa. A dead manuscript out of the drawer, and I sent it away to a writer's workshop because it was the only way to get in. Mm-hmm. To the Asaba writer's retreat is I raised Asaba pigs. And the only way to get on the island was to pretend to be a writer. And I hadn't written anything in years. And so I pulled out this old manuscript from high school and I submitted it. And I went to the retreat. I saw the pigs. I did some research on the pigs. I changed a lot of how pastured pig farming was done with Asaba pigs and with other pigs from those notes. But I started submitting my poetry again. And that dead project, many of those poems went on to be published in my first poetry book in 2017.
Nice. What's it called?
In the meantime, I just started writing all sorts of things. Oh, that one. It's called Landlocked.
Okay.
The Etymology of Whale, Fish, and Grace. Out of Finishing Line Press. Published it in 2017. It's available on Amazon and all the places. Okay,
I'll check it out.
Thank you. Yeah, it was really unusual. So that was in 2015 that I did that. And then it was published in 2017. The first press I sent it to accepted it. That is not the norm.
That sounds amazing.
Nor has it been my experience since. It was a little overwhelming to have that my first experience, but Finishing mm-hmm. Line, there's a lot of controversy about Finishing Line. They publish a lot. And I found them to be just incredibly helpful. They brought me to the Poet's House in New York City to do a reading. And that had been a dream of mine forever.
That sounds awesome.
So it was bucket list, right? And it was the September before COVID. So I got to see New York before it fell. So it was, you know, not to be trite about the tragedies, right?
Right. But, no. COVID was awful. Magical. Everybody knows that. But
And the riots that happened after, mm-hmm. you know, I stayed at a friend's apartment and now he said that that whole block is abandoned. So,
oh, wow.
They were overtaken by rioters. And that's scary to me.
That is scary.
Yeah, it's a beautiful little neighborhood. So I got to do that. And in the meantime, though, I also got accepted to a residency in Prague, in which the professor in charge of that convinced me to write a screenplay. I did. It's terrible. It is dead. It is so dead.
I like the way you're like,
it started
I
off
wrote a screenplay and
movie.
It's terrible.
It's terrible. It started off as a Hallmark movie and turned into a Quentin Tarantino fan pic. So I reread it. There's no other way to describe it, really. But I reread it and I realized that about 3/4 of the way in, I just hated all the characters and wanted them to die. And so I killed them.
That's one way to accomplish it. Yeah.
Blew the town up. Yeah. Yeah. So I will eventually go back and attempt to revive it. Bring it, either go full on Kill Bill or instead make it the sweet notebooky suicidal love story it intended to be to begin with. I don't know. So, but it was a very useful exercise. It's not wasted time. I mean, I spent 3 months writing it, but I learned so much about story structure and character development and about myself as a writer. Mm-hmm. A lot of folks I've talked to said, well, you could have spent 3 months publishing poetry, writing poetry, pushing that side of it.
Right.
But I'm glad I didn't, because I learned so much. Just like with back in 2004, I got a master's degree in architecture and I wrote a thesis. We talked a little bit about that before we went live, and it's terrible. It's embarrassing. I hope no one ever reads it again, but I learned a lot about myself and about writing through writing. And there's this really famous Ira Glass quote, and the essential part of it is, our tastes are exquisite. That's why we got into this hobby, business, lifestyle, calling. But sometimes our skills do not meet our tastes.
Yep.
And so we feel like we're failing, but it's an upward rise, and we just have to keep practicing for that marathon. It's like a training montage. The screenplay, the original thesis, they're all part of my training montage. And if I just keep at it,
right,
you know, like Kung Fu Panda,
yeah, you don't get better unless you practice like 1,000 times over.
Right.
And you read. You have to read a lot. Over.
Yeah.
Assuming you're writing novels, but yeah.
That's what I tell my students and the other writers I mentor. They're like, how do I become a better writer? And I said, read more.
Mm-hmm. See what other people
read
are doing.
More. Read more.
You just naturally start to understand how a story is supposed to go after just ingesting all of those other stories. Or one would hope.
And you'll also see the possibilities there are, because not everything, I mean, there's some really experimental things going on, especially in poetry, where, you know, there are rules and there are no rules, and you have to know the rules to break the rules and play with it. And I work in sonnet form a lot, and I just went to a lecture this summer that talked about breaking the sonnet form, and they're called broken sonnets when they're not perfect, which I just love the idea.
That sounds beautiful.
But I had never heard of that. It is. It is beautiful. I'd never heard of the form of guzzle or however. I've never seen it or heard it pronounced until recently. So I thought it was ghazal, like almost like the animal, but it's guzzle, and it's an Arabic form, and it's absolutely beautiful. But I'd never have encountered it. And so I've never been able to attempt it.
You can't write something you haven't read already, sort of.
Correct.
Yeah. Correct. It sort of goes together.
I read somewhere that you have to put 10,000 hours into something to begin to be good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And you read 10,000 hours worth of poetry, you're going to have a good understanding.
Right. That doesn't mean you can write good poetry, but it means you have an understanding of poetry.
No. Correct. Correct.
You have then had to put in 10,000 hours of writing poetry in order to be good at writing poetry.
Correct. Yes. So I try to do it side by side, and I'm making up for 20 years of pig farming instead.
So what else you got in the old dead project bin?
Oh, okay. So then I have a lot. I had a whole notebook of Abecedarians that was stolen when I visited San Francisco in June. So if any of your listeners happen to have found a notebook on the side of the road in San Jose, and it happens to have Abecedarians in it, you know, I'm still crossing my fingers, I'll get that back. My laptop, my camera, everything was stolen. So the thing I couldn't replace was that notebook with 2 years worth of Abecedarians, which, in case your listeners don't know what an Abecedarian is, it is an alphabetical form of a poem. So each line starts with A, B, C, D, or the end of the line is alphabetical. It's a poetry form playing with the alphabetical form. And I had been studying that and playing with them, and I had an entire notebook full.
That sounds like it would take a lot of time to do.
I did it as a nightly exercise to just keep writing and keep my brain in writing mode. And then This isn't so much as a dead project as it is a deflated project, but it's out there. I tell a lot of funny stories about the last 5 years. So 5 years ago, horrible divorce, right? Mm-hmm. I got nothing but the kids, three beehives, and a lot of student loan debt that all shifted to me. So I moved to Georgia, and I spent 1 week like binge watching Ashley Judd serial killer movies. Okay. And decided to move from Iowa to Georgia. I know it seems really unrelated, right? But bear with me. When I got here, I was like, what do women my age do to start over and rebuild a life? Well, of course, they buy a house and fix it up. So I found a house on foreclosure on 3 acres. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like, you know, under a sun, but with no money, with three kids, and doing it all myself. I'm writing a memoir about that. But you know, I walk away from it so often to work on the pig book, to work on poems, mm-hmm. that it feels like it's a zombie in the corner, just kind of like moaning at me every now and then. Want your brains.
I feel like I have like six of those.
So I kind of like, yeah. So I kind of like look over at it every now and then and go, yeah, I know you're still there. We'll get to you. You know, you're the undead. So we'll be back later.
I promise. I promise I'll come back and fix you.
Yes. So, you know, that comes out a chapter at a time. There's a link on my website to the opening to that. It was published in House Beautiful.
Okay.
Right. I just... But they put out a call on a pitch page that said, has anybody ever bought a house post-divorce? And I was like, oh, yeah. This is me. I bought a house post-divorce. And everybody else was like, I got a huge settlement and I bought a brownstone and it helped me establish my identity. And that's awesome. But I did it trashed credit. And right. Yeah, it was really good. You know, if you have that opportunity, go for it. Right. But, yeah, my credit was intentionally trashed, and I had to find a co-signer and a bank that would lend to me and then buy a house on foreclosure for next to nothing. Mm-hmm. So I wrote about how, you know, in 1500 words, how I bought a house that was abandoned just like me. Ooh. And if it could survive being abandoned, so could I.
That's
and
nice.
And I was going to rebuild my life. Yeah. Yeah, it's more than just good bones, right?
Right.
Which I love that saying in real estate. You know, the house has good bones, but it needed more than good bones. It needed to have enough strength to hold me and my grief and my pain and,
right.
and with every
it had to have
every
strong
nail
bones.
I pulled and every piece of plaster. Yeah, yeah. And the house was built in 1875 and survived so many hurricanes, including the first year we were there, Hurricane Matthew. So, you know, I've got quite a lot to write about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I moved to Georgia and Georgia hasn't had a hurricane in 70 years and bam, we get hit.
It was just waiting for you.
You know, it was, you know, the kids had a good time. They were like, yay, no school. But a lot of my farm skills actually got us through that week because we had no power or internet signal or phone signal for 6 days, and mm-hmm. our street had live oaks crisscrossing and we couldn't get out to go somewhere else. And maybe I should have evacuated, but we didn't because we didn't know any better.
Right.
And so we just basically barbecued everything we had in the deep freeze and bathed with buckets in the yard and had a great time.
That sounds, I'm not going to say fun.
No, I mean, it's fun to write about now. Mm-hmm. You know, I had musical instruments, the kids played around, we made up stories. It was, you know, mm-hmm. it was what it was.
Yeah.
A lot of cleaning up storm debris and meeting the neighbors. And
how old were your kids then?
And the like, oh my gosh, they were 10, 7, and 5.
Ooh, wow. It's on the younger end of things.
Or 11, 7, and 5. Yeah, they were, that was the first year we moved here that Matthew hit. And then the next year, I think, was Florence. And then the next year was another one. I lost track after a while.
So you're getting used to hurricanes is what you're saying.
Since moving here. Oh yeah. And I ended up selling the house to a family who wanted, after it was fixed up, it went viral on For the Love of Old Houses and sold within a couple of days to a wonderful couple who is fixing it up they're finishing the kitchen because I could never decide what countertops to put in.
Right.
So they're finishing that. And then they are turning it into a bed and breakfast.
Ooh, that sounds nice. Put your legacy to good work.
Yeah. So I bought a house on a little bit higher ground.
Sounds like a smart move.
Yeah. And everybody's happy. My kids are happy. They're happy. We're all happy. So, you know, I'm going to write about that. I'm going to write about it. And I am writing about it in pieces and other things. And things just keep getting, I had this other notebook in which I had poetry that I was writing through the trauma and the violence of both the divorce, the last 5 years of the marriage, because we were married 17 years, something like that, together. Okay. 20, you know, the last 5 years, of course, are the collapsing years. And so mm-hmm. I was writing poetry to get myself through that. But also writing about how brutal and violent farm life is, because I couldn't put that in my pig book.
Right.
No one would eat meat after that. So I was working through some of the brutality of farm life. One of my issues, and I do talk about this in Pig a lot, is that we are so hyper-focused on animal welfare. We forget that a lot of the farming techniques, the modern farming techniques, are for the welfare of the people doing it. And
yeah,
so
yeah, I guess you do forget about
from that.
And
to raise animals under the animal welfare approved standard, sometimes standard of care for the people doing it really drops. And it can be brutal and hard and harsh, especially in harsh climates like Iowa. And so I was writing through that in my poems, and I was short. I also write about physics poems, like quantum entanglements and stars exploding. And that's the poetry that usually goes out and gets published.
Mm-hmm.
But I was short a poem for a packet that gets sent out, because you send out 3, 5, 7 at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was short. So I pulled one from my farm brutality packet and sent it off and didn't think about it till a year later, when that's the poem that got picked. And that poem appeared. It was called Cold Water and Cut Dough. It was about canning peaches and also had other things as metaphor. And it was in American Poetry Review, very well received.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, especially with the comments people started giving me, that it was something that they related to, that they really needed to hear about, to hear about that side of farming and of violence. And so I started sending off more from that side.
Right.
And that's the poem. Those are the poems that started getting published. And so, you know, for me, it wasn't so much, it was a dead project. I was doing it just for me,
mm-hmm.
and never intending it to come to light. And this little tug just kind of pulled it up and back into the light. And that's been hard for me, harder than any other project I've come back to, actually.
Really? Why? Just revisiting the years?
I think it's revisiting trauma in a way I didn't expect to be reliving it while I'm revising.
Okay.
And the reception of it when I'm like, I brought a packet of these to a workshop over the summer. And I did not expect to, like, I'm really good at getting criticism in a workshop. I'm like, bring it. It's going to make me better. I'm going to
criticism only makes better.
Suggestions. I'm going to work them in. Right. And instead I sat in the workshop, almost shaking and crying afterwards. But I don't cry. And I've been through a lot and I don't cry. And here I am just like sobbing because I could not handle people questioning the validity of lines. Even though they were questioning, does this line belong in this poem? It felt like they were questioning me and my experience,
mm-hmm.
my real lived experience. And as a survivor of domestic violence, that's a very taboo topic. It's still a place where people blame the victim. Because of, you know, you choose to stay, you chose that partner, you chose those circumstances, those, mm-hmm. those violences happened because of a series of choices you made, your responsibility. And so I also I don't agree with that at all. No, of course not. But it is still out there. And even if it's not how people are receiving it, it is what is happening in the brain of a survivor, mm-hmm. because they do blame themselves for those choices. Mm-hmm. And so to hear any sort of echo of that, like confirming what they're already hearing in their head, mm-hmm. it's really hard. It's really hard to process through. And so I had fictionalized the characters in my poem, and I did not, I had a series of 20 poems that I brought, and each one was a different woman, a different topic, a different story I had borrowed from. And then I realized as I'm sitting there, no, that is what happened to me. That is what I experienced, and don't question that. And it was suddenly I'm here on the end of a workshop where I've taken students through workshops. Mm-hmm. And I've seen them have these reactions. It's never been me. And I'd always been criticism makes you stronger. And here I am just completely torn apart. I left the conference early. Actually, I couldn't handle another day. It was.
That sounds brutal.
Very revealing about my, it was. It was very brutal. And once I got home and I got relaxed, I could work through it. And I realized that this was hard for me in a way that I needed it to be. It was criticism that I needed to get myself out of that mire of just what do they call it? Abrading scars and scabs.
Okay.
Like writing through this, I was revisiting trauma in a way that wasn't healthy. Mm-hmm. Just over and over again. And I needed to put it in the dead drawer for a while and come back to it when I'm a little bit stronger.
Okay. I have two things I want to say about
this. So in that way, I'm saying, yes.
I don't read poetry that much. I mean, just I'm more of a fiction, pick up a book, novel, read it. So I don't read a lot of poetry. And even though it's hard for you, I feel kind of weird saying this, but they sound beautiful. Are you planning on putting these into like a collection and published?
I was hoping to eventually. Okay. But when you publish something, part of publishing it means you have to do a lot of readings. And I think that part for me is part of it is what was making me feel nervous too. Even in the workshop, mm-hmm. reading them out loud. So I have several of them from the series that are published. American Poetry Review published the one last mm-hmm. summer, and Railroad Review published one. Driftwood Press has one out from a few years ago. They're dropped here and there. Mm-hmm. What was the most recent one? I wrote one about miscarriage, because miscarriage is horrible.
Yes.
For any woman. But for a domestic violence victim who has no family and all a family is estranged and no friends, it is an even more isolating experience that they may not even be able to tell their partner it happened for fear of retribution. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a poem about that. And that one and another one went viral on Twitter. And that's why I had to get Twitter, because somebody said, hey, you post on Twitter and it's going nuts. I was like, really? Okay, let's log in and find out what's going on. But people really responded in amazing ways to the work that was very affirming and nurturing to mm-hmm. me. So eventually I feel like this kind of work needs to be out there. But I'm just not ready to do that yet.
Okay. That's like fair.
It's still enough on life support. Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I wanted to say was, regarding criticism, I mean, it's one thing to go to a workshop and when you're working on a novel where it's an entire fictionalized story and they're talking about your grammar use or your word placement. I mean, that's a whole nother beast of criticism. That's the criticism I'm familiar with. So, but I think criticism for poetry is like, the poetry has to be much more personal to you. Like, it must feel like they're attacking you, because I feel like poetry is all like 100% personal, as opposed to like the fictional story that you just pulled out of your brain. So I can understand why you would just be reduced to nothing after criticism of your poetry.
Yeah, but I had attended workshops before where they criticized my poetry, and that hadn't happened. I was just eagerly taking notes, like, okay, how do I make this better? How do I make this work? And so this just crossed a line into something that was, it was just a very, very different experience for me. And I always joke too that fiction is often more true than nonfiction. Nonfiction uses a lot of fiction in it. It's the stories, nonfiction and memoir are the fictions that we have invented about ourselves. That's what I tell my students. The lines are gray and blurred between them, and poetry sometimes are fictional vignettes. Some of them are like abstract paintings at times, or photographs. They're just a moment, just a sliver of time.
Right.
And it is so much easier to occupy that moment in that short form. But when that moment is a cage, that's a whole another thing. But I had walked students and poetry mentees through this process and had never experienced the emotional response that I experienced myself. And I think that itself was useful. I think I'll go forward being a more empathetic teacher. But I'm 2 months out from that experience, and I'm still like tearing up a little. It was so hard. Yeah. And I, you know, it's a little embarrassing too, to show that kind of weakness and vulnerability. But I think once it comes to life again, that I'll have a better and clearer view of what it needs to be, and then it'll be out in the world doing its work. That's another thing about poetry, is sometimes when we release it, it does its own work, and the poem becomes its own living thing.
I could see that happening.
And it's weird, like when it went viral on Twitter. Which one? Carrie DeRatio went viral, and so did Mary Celeste, which was about a cancer diagnosis. So, it's one of those really buried metaphors, but the Mary Celeste was a ghost ship that was found. And so I used that metaphor for carrying cancer and not knowing it, and then knowing it. So watching those go viral and seeing how people, when they shared them, they also shared their own stories. So it became a vessel in which people were sharing their own and connecting with other people with shared experiences. So this almost web of network that had the root and hub was something I made that had a life of its own. It was really interesting to watch that happen. And I liked it. It was neat. It was really, really cool.
And releasing something, I can't speak for poetry because I don't write it, but releasing something like that almost into the wild always feels like you're letting go of a balloon, like, and just letting the wind take it. And just you kind of eventually lose track of where it's going and who's seeing it.
Yeah. Every now and then I'll get emails from people who picked up my books. And one poem or another really spoke to them, and they just had to reach out to me and say, this piece right here, I see myself in this. Or conversely, my own sister is not, after my book came out, she doesn't speak to me, which is a big reaction.
Right.
Because there's a poem in my first book about her, about my mother. When my mother was pregnant with my sister, and I was 4 years old. My memory of it. Right.
Right.
So I wrote it.
It's a sliver of your life.
No business to write that. Yes. And And so sometimes when we release things, they have consequences that cannot be foreseen, that are not great. And, you know, I miss my sister terribly. We don't live in the same state, but we have children the same age. So I miss her. I missed that, you know, that consequence.
Right.
Was not expected.
That's too bad. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Me too. But I, that the same happens to a lot of writers. They'll write a memoir or even a fiction book in which someone mm-hmm. see in their life sees themselves in, and then they're like, I can't talk to you anymore. Oof. That you crossed a line, you crossed a boundary, you broke a trust, and boom, mm-hmm. done. So I think that is something a lot of writers experience. It's currency. It's currency that mm-hmm. we carry.
Yeah, just your everything that, we experience is currency for writing.
Yes.
Yeah, in my latest.
Yes, and I've actually had.
No, go ahead. No, go. Go ahead. This is about you.
To a new neighborhood and. Okay. No, I moved to a new neighborhood and I introduced myself as a writer for the first time before. Mm-hmm. I've always had other labels. And one of the moms was like, okay, I can't be friends with you. Sorry.
That's like an extreme reaction.
Okay. Okay, cool. So, yeah, you know, I guess there's, you know, everything in my life is up for writing about, and I mm-hmm. understand that, okay, I can respect that.
Yeah. Yeah. In my latest work, I had to, put a disclaimer in the front because, all my, like my whole family was basically going to read this thing. And it was heavily based on the area that my grandparents lived in. And therefore, like all my aunts and uncles grew up in and stuff. I'd be like, this is fake. I only use the setting. Like, none of this is about the family. Like, I had to put that out there and be like, this is just figments of my imagination. This is not actually about grandma or grandpa. Like, they were not witches. I promise.
Nice. Yeah. And it, of course, there's always family that will see themselves in the work as
exactly.
well. Right.
Yeah.
So yeah. Yeah. Necessary. Yes. And, you know, I think, you know, as I was writing the screenplay too, I was using composites of people that I knew in real life, not even mm-hmm. realizing it. And I thought to myself too, are they not going to, you know, if they recognize themselves in it, in the bad behavior, then they're kind of admitting to it as well. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So it's sort of a catch-22 if they claim that it's
then
they're
also,
they claim it's something they don't like and it's there.
Right.
They're also
admitting it's also their bad
and
stuff
the best
along with their good stuff.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I tell my husband flat out that I use at least a piece of him in almost every male character I write. Like, it might not be all, but there's at least a thread of him in every single one.
Hey, I'm just now remembering there's a writer couple I know. She's a poet. He's a fiction writer. And he was so jealous of her first boyfriend mm-hmm. that he has a character named after him in every one of his books in which he kills.
That is amazing. I think yeah. maybe he should let it go by now.
Right. Right. Yeah.
I mean, he married the woman.
She wrote a really hilarious poem about it. So. Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And they've been married a long time. Well, you know, a couple writer goals.
Right. Good for them. I'm glad they can work through the stress yeah. of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So we're starting to near our hour mark, and I've got a couple questions for you.
Wow.
I know, it goes fast. Excellent. One, what do you do to improve?
Oh, to improve my writing?
Or yourself in the business of writing.
The business of writing, I'm always pushing forward, trying to learn more things, asking questions to the people who are doing things successfully. Mm-hmm. How are you doing that? One good thing that came out of the conference was I met another writer and she said, the future of promotion is newsletters. And I was like, I've never, what? newsletters. Like, that's kind of old fashioned. Like, we're mailing out newsletters. And she said, no, like Substack, like email, MailChimp. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's something we used MailChimp when I worked at a museum 20 years ago. So, or however long ago that was. So I was like, okay, yeah. You know, I used to design a newsletter on Microsoft Publisher. And she's like, no, not that. And so she walked me through the process of setting up a newsletter. And I think it's going to be a really valuable part of how I start promoting things. So I was really excited about that. And then I'm learning about podcasting before I jump in and do it. Always asking questions, trying to see what people are doing well and listening to them. When I started doing readings, I hired a voice coach.
Ooh, nice.
And I could do readings better. You know, I try to think about all the different aspects of how we get out there as writers. I'm extremely introverted. So doing a reading takes a lot out of me, and I have a routine, almost a ritual to how I prepare for it. I don't eat beforehand. That helps a lot. I don't know why, but I don't eat anything and I do better. I rest my voice. I use honey lozenges, and then I get up there and I do it. And I remember like why and how. But the big thing the voice coach told me is read slower than you think it should be, because in your head it's going normal pace, but it's faster than the audience can take it in. And so pacing meant a lot, which means reading less work and having to curate which poems make the arc and tell the story and practicing ahead of time. So that was part of it. And then how to sign your books at a book signing. That's not something I ever thought of.
That's not something I ever thought of.
Some people want, you know, the little blurb. So I started picking up when people, like this one here is by Jen Gavon. And she wrote this in here. You can't read that. It says, may all your journeys be magical and all your birds surreal. And it's wonderful. It's from her book.
Oh, that's which nice. That's a nice little tie-in.
Prompts. And so I started asking other authors, and they're like, yeah, we take something from our book and we make it into a message that is easily memorized that we can write there, or various, you know, they say, what's your favorite poem in the book? You look it up real quick and you write some version of that as a personalized piece of it.
Wow. And that's very nice. I love that idea.
Yeah. I never thought of doing anything other than signature.
Right. Other than just signing your name, like literally just signing your name.
Right. The other thing some of them do is, again, this is going to be backwards for you, but you see how she wrote her name kind of over where it is? Some authors actually cross out the printed name.
Really?
No.
I did not know that. I'm learning new things here.
No. Yeah. And so I ask questions. I take notes. I carry notebooks around with me everywhere. I write down tips, advice, like what advice would you give me? One poet told me the best advice she could give me was that if I was going to wear red fingernail polish, to carry a bottle with me and touch it up in the car before going in anywhere. Which seems like good advice for any poet to give advice to another poet. Yeah, but now when I do readings, I have killer red nails. And you know, because the tips always chip off. No matter what I'm doing, like between when I do them or have someone else do them, the tips chip off. She said, just carry a bottle, touch it up. No one will be able to tell. So I thought that was an interesting observation. Another one, very helpful thing I just learned. Another writer, friend of mine, she was giving a reading over Zoom. And somebody got on there and exposed themselves, like full on genitalia. Whoa. Really, right?
Uh-huh.
Not something you think about happening in a Zoom reading. And so she said her new standard is to have them locked, like you let the guests in, but having a second admin or host monitoring that, so you don't have to do it during the reading.
That's smart. You know, that is a very good idea.
Her focus was trying to do both. Yeah. And it's not something I had considered before ever.
No, because I feel like who would do that to add a reading? Like, why? I had another question.
If you have an audience of 1,000
I guess,
people.
Yeah, that's, that's reason enough. it sounds like some of this has been really hard on you, some of the poetry. How have the people in your life supported you during it?
Okay. Yeah, that's been a really good question. That is a really good question. So I have, right now, I'm married to a very supportive man. He's also a novelist and a poet. So he knows a lot about the business from the back end too. He insisted at this new house that, I don't know if you can see it in the background, this is my writing space and my art studio. And it was one of the criterias for our new space is that I had to have a dedicated room of my own.
That's and nice.
I love that. My parents will sometimes watch my kids when I have to go on long conferences, and it's good to have somebody that I can trust. And then I don't have to pay huge amounts of money. Right. But I can be gone 4 weeks at a time and not have to worry so much about my kids. Or I have friends who just, they don't like poetry. They show up at my poetry readings anyway. When I've traveled over the United States, some of them have set up readings. My book tour, I went, I started off in the town I attended fifth grade with several other poets who also, they graduated from that high school, but I didn't. So, but they set up the reading, and then that was like my book launch was there. And that was really special and amazing that those friends from fifth grade took it on themselves to set that up for me. And then I went back to Iowa and I did a series there, and it was just so many people, my former customers showing up, my former customers constantly nagging me and pestering. I'll go ahead and say pestering for me to write
in a nice way.
It's just been incredibly supportive. Yes. Yes. And I've had friends just randomly send me $50 and say, I don't imagine being a poet is profitable and submissions are expensive. So please, as a birthday gift or whatever, use this for submission fees.
That sounds like you have amazing friends.
I do. I have really amazing friends. You know, and sometimes I'll just visit them in their cities, and I have this thing I do. So when I go visit someone in a city I've never been, I tell them to take me to eat where they love to eat, not what's famous about the city, but their favorite place. And then I order what they order. Their favorite, and I order what they order. And if they have no idea, then I ask the waitress or waiter, what would you order? What's your favorite thing here? And then I have them walk me around the city, the friend, not the waiter, waitress, and show me what they love about the place they live. Yeah. Show me what you love about the place you live. And then I photograph it, and I'm able to give them back their photographs. And I love that, you know, it's, I can later write about those experiences. They've given them to me, and then I give them something back. I love it when I see them use my photos as their Facebook page, profile pictures, just a simple joy.
That is so sweet.
My friends and family, they support my work in ways that is so nurturing and healthy. I love it, you know, except for my sister. You know, like we, right. Except for her. She's not a big fan, but yeah, I really appreciate how they, you know, they buy my books. Mm-hmm. How else can you support your writer friends? You buy their books, you show up to their readings, and you like their posts that are their poems, and you share their poems and you share their book reviews, and you do that, you know. It's harder to review your friends' books on Amazon now, though, because they lock you out if they have a Facebook association with you. But you know, there are other ways to share those reviews and get that work out. But it's so helpful. So helpful. It really does. It keeps me going in so many ways, you know. And even when I was struggling at the conference, I had a friend in my pocket the whole time cheering me on and sending me like gifts of, I can't even think of it. There's this new cult favorite where these two women, Barb and Star, go to something Del Mar. Yeah. And she kept sending me little clips from the movie saying, this is us. We'll go to wherever. Is it Vista Del Mar?
I think
we'll go there and we'll wear culottes. Yeah. And she says, as soon as you get out of here, you can write about it, but buy yourself a pair of culottes. And,
that's awesome.
And shell earrings. I'm like, okay.
I am jealous of your friend base. Like, you have some really awesome friends. That is very lucky.
Yeah. I feel really blessed. And especially because as a writer and an introvert, I'm not always present in their lives. Yes. I'm just over here creating. And And, you know, they seem to understand that and love me anyway.
That's great. Next question is, what's your favorite story? TV, books, movies?
My favorite.
Any story, but what's your favorite one?
Oh, my goodness. I got different answers for different genres, right?
Well, just like pick whatever's top of your head.
My favorite TV show is Longmire. I love Longmire. I revisit it over and over again. I was born in Colorado. I know it's filmed in like New Mexico, but set in Wyoming. Uh-huh. But like the vistas are exactly like what I grew up with. So whenever I'm feeling homesick, I go to Longmire. My favorite true crime novel is The Garden of Good and Evil. It's why I moved to Savannah, Georgia. I was obsessed with
that
book.
Who doesn't love that novel?
I loved the way it was written. I actually went, there's another book that came out, somebody trying to tell the true story behind it that includes like the court records. I read that too. I read all of it. I've gone on all the tours, obsessed over it. Interesting way to write about a crime that happened. And I love that. Right now, my favorite poet is A.E. Stallings. She's based out of Greece, but she's from here in Georgia. And her work is just exquisite, especially her Greek mythology poems. And she's who introduced me to the guzzle, because she had a guzzle come out in, I don't know what poetry journal, but something. It came out in this week, and I shared it on Facebook. It was absolutely stunning. It was stunning. Her work with craft and story within these forms is just amazing. And I hope that someday be half as good as she is. Right. So then I'm just thinking of like my favorites are sometimes what I'm reading right now.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
My favorite poetry prompt book is the one I'm reading. Jen Gavon's Regenerate: Prompts to Unlock Transformation. I have so many favorites. I just love books. I love books. Like, I don't know if you can see behind me, like I have about 9 more of those. I just love books.
Bookshelves.
That was really hard in the divorce, is I lost shelves, so many shelves, books. And I've got books in boxes still, but in the divorce, I lost
the floor.
All my books, except for three boxes of poetry books. That's all I got in the divorce. And so I've had to rebuild. And I think that's been kind of the fun part is, you know, finding the books that I loved. And buying them again, it's like Christmas.
And rediscovering your love for them. Remembering why you liked them the first
place.
And
then the new books along the way. Yeah.
Yes. Everybody on this podcast has a minor book obsession.
That's good.
That's what the podcast is about.
What was it? Okay, so then my favorite science fiction book of all time, and this is going to like, hold on, I've got it here on my desk. If I hold it up, no one's going to see it because it's backwards, right?
Right.
So Robert Heinlein, who's famous for Stranger in a Strange Land, he also wrote a series of kids' books. Okay. And one of them is called Podcane of Mars. And I just love that book so much that for a little while I went to sci-fi conventions dressed as Podcane.
Oh,
but it's just
awesome.
Basically a pilot suit. She was a pilot.
Uh-huh.
Right? Like a Firefly Kaylee. She was basically Kaylee. That I think that's who they based that character on. And so I would go and they'd be like, "Who?" And I'm like, "Robert Heinlein. Haven't you ever read
carry around
Heinlein?
The book
how,
with you?
How like... can you not be a fan if you've never heard that?" Carry it in my pocket, you know, and
hand out copies.
Yeah, so that's my favorite middle grade sci-fi book is the Podcane of Mars and the others in that series. I just adore those. But I read so much. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, every little sliver. I also carry a pocket dictionary with me. I grew up reading, but not in a reader family.
Right.
And so I often encountered words for the first time by reading them. And then I read that Malcolm X taught himself to read from a dictionary, copying the pages of the dictionary over and over again. And that's how he taught himself to read and what all the words meant, and that language is power. And when my daughter turned 11, she didn't get a letter from Hogwarts. Instead, I gave her a dictionary and I said, this is real magic here. This mm-hmm. is words. She didn't believe me until the neighbor girl stole her dictionary to do her homework because she didn't have internet. And then, wow, mom, you're right. Language and books, they are power. They are privilege. Mm-hmm. And they are magic. So I carry a pocket dictionary with me. Sometimes when I just get stuck, I open it up to just a word, learn a new word, and see if a poem can come out of it. That's actually how I started writing about quantum physics and poetry.
Oh, yeah? Because of your pocket dictionary?
It was pocket dictionary, which I got at City Lights Bookstore in San Francisco. I'd never been there, and I always wanted to go. So I picked up a pocket dictionary to replace my other one. And I opened it and it said concupiscence. And that is an amazing word, which basically means the beginning and root of lust. Concupiscence. Okay. And so I wrote a poem from there, but on that same page was the word Coriolis effect. Coriolis effect is how the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern mm-hmm. Hemisphere spin in different directions water-wise. Right. And I love that. It's two things to be a whole and still be spinning in different directions.
Mm-hmm. I need to read your poetry book now. Like I said, I don't read poetry, but after I'm done with this, I'm totally going to Amazon and getting your book.
Well, thank you.
A way to support people on the podcast, but also just I have a minor addiction to books and reading, so this just feeds my addiction.
Yeah. Thank you.
No problem. And final question before we sign off is, what's your writing excuse? Why are you not writing today? Tongue in cheek, realistic, your choice.
Why am I not writing?
What's your writing excuse today?
My writing excuse today was it was Labor Day and we had unexpected out-of-town guests show up and they came a long, long way. So, you know, we had to be good hosts and that was my husband's writing excuse too. You know, we had to tidy up the house, we had to mm-hmm. get the kids fed and we had to entertain. They were his aunts. They just came up from North Georgia. And then my aunt was here because she's moving here.
Okay.
And so she's spending her days with us while her house is getting finished. And so that has been my writing excuse. In some ways, for several weeks, her moving here has been a lot. I love her. I love her. And she mm-hmm. is one of the reasons I was able to create this life I have now. She was my co-signer.
Nice.
On that house. And, she has supported my writing in so many ways. She's such an inspiration. She's a whole nother book. She used to race sled dogs and raise buffalo and fly planes and fight fires in rural Colorado. She's lived quite a life.
Oh my goodness. This woman needs to write a memoir.
Someday I'll write a book about her. Yeah.
Okay. What do you think, readers and writers? What's your writing excuse? Let me know on Twitter at RNW Podcast or on Instagram at Read and Write Podcast. If you're interested in anything we mentioned, you always can find it in the show notes on readandwritepodcast.com. And don't forget, you can find Danelle on Twitter at Danelle Lejeune or on Instagram at Danelle Lejeune Author. And that's it. Thank you for listening to the show. If you like what you're hearing, make sure to rate Read and Write on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you have a suggestion for a future episode, drop me a line. I'm always open to suggestions. Also, did you know that Read and Write publishes 3 episodes a week? Check out the podcast's YouTube channel for Write With Me Mondays live streams and 30-second book reviews on Fridays.